So, little summary of where we've been so far. So, in our first session, we talked about what I think is life's greatest privilege, which is the opportunity to really apprentice under Jesus in all areas of life. And we talked about how you really apprentice under Jesus can kind of be summed up in three words. You know, abide, imitate, and obey. And then in our second session, we talked about how as apprentices of Jesus, we really want to utilize and be good stewards of one of the most valuable resources he gives us, which is our time. And as we utilize our time well, we want to really focus not on just good, wise use of our time practices, but also where we're giving our time. We want to really center it on God and his kingdom. And really, as we give our lives to God and to people, the two things that will last forever, we're actually investing in things that are going to be in God's kingdom forever, and that's well worth our time. And what we should give our time to was could really mainly be summed up in Matthew 6:33, where it says, "But seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all these other things will be given to you." As we prioritize the kingdom of God and seeking its advancement in the world and different people's lives over time, God will take care of the rest, you know. He sees to that. And so we tend to sometimes get focused on all the other things. And God says, no, I will take care of all the things. You focus on what I've given you. You know, you focus on walking with me as a disciple. You focus on making disciples and seeking my kingdom. See where I'm working and join me in that. And I will, in stride, take care of the rest. Now, under the umbrella of seeking God's kingdom first, you know, God has given us a specific mission as disciples of his to accomplish. And he unpacks that and lays that out in Matthew 28:18-20. And we're not going to all unpack that further in our last session, but just as a way to look at that real quick here, in Matthew 28:18-20, it's what's commonly referred to as a Great Commission. He says this, says, "Then Jesus came to them and said," this is at the end of his life, as he's about to ascend up into heaven. He says, "All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me." Basically, I am the big kahuna. I am the whole enchilada right here. "Therefore, go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit, and teaching them to obey everything I have commanded you. And surely I am with you always to the very end of the age." So our mission is given to us by Jesus. We don't have to make it up. We don't have to discover it or create it. It's there. God has given all of us the mission, if you're a follower of him, to be a disciple and to make disciples of him. Now, that's going to take courage. That's going to take time. It's going to take sacrifice, but it is worth it. It is so worth it. In fact, you guys are here today because people before you, like Cody and Brittany and others, took that mission seriously. That's going to require leadership and pace setting. You know, in 1 Corinthians 11:1, Paul says, "Follow my example as I follow the example of Christ." The older I get, I realize this cannot just be a side hobby or something that we're just really interested in. This really has to be what we center our lives around, what we really leverage our resources for. But this is the big but. But before we make disciples and we lead others and we begin to shepherd others in that, we're going to face our greatest leadership challenge every single day when we look into the mirror. And I don't mean your hair and the issues you have with that. That's actually why I shaved my head, so I don't have to worry about it. But no, I'm talking about just leading yourself. Leading yourself is actually going to be your greatest leadership challenge. So if you can learn to lead yourself, leading others is going to be no problem, because that will be your greatest leadership challenge. Whether you're a senior or a sophomore, or whether you're on staff, your greatest leadership challenge will always be leading yourself. My greatest leadership challenge will always be leading myself. I mean, people can go, "Man, you have a staff and a family and all these students to lead. Like, is that difficult?" I'm like, nowhere near as difficult as leading myself. Like, that is the hardest part, you know. But yeah, that does take some work. But man, leading myself, that's where it really gets difficult. But if you can learn to lead yourself well, I can almost guarantee that at least two things are going to result from that. At least two things. One, first, you'll find that you will have more influence in the lives of other people. And the reason for that is exceptional self-leadership is the key to sustained influence. Exceptional self-leadership is the key to sustained influence. In fact, you will not be a leader worth following if you don't lead yourself well. Case in point, think about your parents. You know, whether or not you want to be like your mom or dad has far less to do with what they said and what they taught, but more about how they modeled their lives, how they led themselves. You know, you find for most people, you're rarely open to influence. You're rarely willingly open to influence of people you don't respect. You may do what they say because they have authority over you, whether they're your boss or your teacher or your parent or something like that. But rarely do you open yourselves up to influence from people you don't respect. Instead, we tend to be influenced by those we do respect, and those we respect always have one thing in common. They lead themselves well. So not only will leading yourself well lead to sustained influence in the lives of others, but exceptional self-leadership will also lead to sustained performance. It'll lead to sustained performance. All of you, I'm sure, and as I've gotten to know more of you, really talented people. I mean, we have like hidden soccer stars. We have all sorts of things I didn't know about you guys. USC, I'm constantly amazed at the hidden talents of the students there. Like, they're like low-key, like, yeah, I play five instruments. I speak three languages. I do these kind of things. I'm like, what? Like, yeah, you know, I started a business when I was 12 and stuff. Like, oh my gosh, like, that is not true of me. I have no hidden talents. What you see is what you get. In fact, some of the things you see I made up are not actually my talents. But that is just true of so many people I see at USC, and I'm sure it's true of you guys too. But what I would tell you, though, is your talent will not be enough to lead yourself well. When you look at leaders who falter in leadership, rarely is their fault in leadership a lack of talent issue. It's almost always because of a lack of self-leadership that they falter. Another way of saying that is it's usually a lack of character, not a lack of skill, that causes people to lose their leadership and have their lives come crashing down. Great leaders last because they lead themselves well. So how can we learn to lead ourselves well? Well, I think there's at least three decisions that every one of us is going to have to make if we're going to be able to lead ourselves well. There's probably more, but these are at least three. And the first decision is this: I will not lie to myself, even when the truth makes me feel bad about myself. I will not lie to myself, even when the truth makes me feel bad about myself. You know, in our culture today, often the worst thing that can happen to you is you feel bad about yourself. You know, you feel guilty, you have low self-esteem or something like that. But maybe you've lived long enough to realize that's actually not the worst thing that could happen to you. And if you think it is, just wait, live a little longer. You won't. The worst thing that could actually happen to you is to hold on to something that's actually bad about yourself because you're not willing to acknowledge that something's bad about yourself. That's actually worse. You know, for instance, I mean, I have tons of examples of this, but in eighth grade, I had to finally acknowledge that I wasn't just joking around when I was making fun of people. Like, I was the king at, like, just ripping people verbally. I was so good at it, and I did it eloquently. Like, I mean, with my siblings, with my friends, everything. And, yeah, there would be, you know, just emotionally bloody trails of people. But I thought, guys, I'm just joking. I'm just joking. Until finally, it finally dawned on me as one of my guy friends who's in eighth grade is crying because I, you know, was making jokes so much at his expense, I thought, maybe I'm not just joking. Maybe I actually need to stop doing that. But I had to really be honest with myself. Exceptional self-leadership requires being brutally honest about yourself. So if I lie to myself to make me feel better about myself, I'll never improve and lead myself well. And here's the hard part. The hard part is there is no one better at deceiving yourself than yourself. Right? Think about that. You are a sucker for all of your own ideas. I am a sucker for all of my own ideas. We get an idea and we immediately begin to sell ourselves on it. We immediately begin to rationalize things. We've all purchased things. We have all eaten things. We've all dated things that we probably shouldn't have, because we sold ourselves on our own desires. So if you're going to lead yourself well, you've got to be brutally honest with yourself. So a simple but effective question you ought to regularly ask yourself is this: why am I doing this, really? Why am I doing this, really? So I want us to, I think I have it up here. Maybe I do, maybe I don't. Do I have it up there on the slide so you guys can all see it? If not, we're going to say it together. I want you guys to all say this. And before we say really, I want there to be a nice, long, pregnant pause before we say really. So why am I doing this really? Okay, ready? 1, 2, 3. Why am I doing this really? Yeah, see, and that last word is key because that helps you to stop lying to yourself. You know, well, I'm doing this because, you know, it's for Jesus. Really? You know, I remember talking to a guy one time. This is totally off script, but he was talking about how I was like, hey, bud, why do you keep trying to, you know, I think you're getting a little too close to some of these girls here. You're not dating them and stuff like that, but the way you're relating, he goes, well, I just really, you know, care about their heart and want to make sure they're really walking with God and this and that. I go, oh, okay. I go, why do you tend to only care about the hearts of the pretty girls? And he goes, what? I go, yeah, none of the girls here that are not that good looking, you don't tend to care about their heart. And he goes, oh, yeah. I go, I don't know, something to think about. So, he's like, yeah, maybe it's right. But why am I doing this really? You owe it to yourself to tell yourself the truth. You don't have to necessarily act off of it, but at least be honest and ask it, why am I doing this really? So before you go to that event, before you watch that show, before you send that text, before you join that club, before you go on that date, or whatever it is, stop and ask yourself, why am I doing this really? It's uncomfortable. It's not always easy, but it is an effective way to lead yourself well. And then the second decision you have to make to really lead yourself well is you will have to make this decision. I will prioritize what I value most over what I want now. I will prioritize what I value most over what I want now. There's lots of things that we want now, but rarely is it what we want most. This is the tension between what is immediate versus what is ultimate. But if we're going to do this, we have to stop and remind ourselves regularly, okay, what is it that I value most? And as followers of Jesus, even more so, we need to say, what does Jesus value most? Because again, if we're apprentices and followers of him, that ultimately is the question. Not what do I value most, but what does he value most? We almost always know what we want now, but often we get foggy about what we value most because there's so much immediate noise of the now clamoring for our own attention. Hebrews 12:11 says this. It says, no discipline seems pleasant at the time, but painful. Later on, however, it produces a harvest of righteousness and peace for those who have been trained by it. We have to take the long-term perspective. We can't be short-sighted by what we just want now. So imagine yourself at the end of your senior year of college. For some of you guys, that's like just a few months away. But for some of you, maybe it's a little more. Imagine yourself at the end of your senior year of college, and there is a banquet, and people are making a toast to you based on and just congratulating you and speaking of the things that they've really seen to be true of growing in your life for the last 4 years. Your parents are there. Your professors are there. Boyfriend or girlfriend's going to make a toast. Your roommates, your friends. What would you want them to say about you? They have really white teeth. You know, they always were dressed to the nines. You know, I don't know. What do you want them to say about you? Think about that and maybe even begin to write that down and let that motivate and keep you focused on what it is that you value most over what you want now, because how you finish is really how you're going to be remembered. We see that all the time with people. We see that with athletes. We see all sorts of things. Like, how you finish is how you're going to be remembered. So finish well and think about the end in mind. Okay, if I want these characteristics to be true of me when I graduate, I've got to back up and get to work on that now. And then the third decision you have to make to lead yourself well is I will not attempt to lead myself by myself. I will not attempt to lead myself by myself. Now, I have a confession to make. And I don't mind making this confession because I think it's true of you too. Did you know that I'm the mastermind behind all my own worst decisions? I am the mastermind behind all of my own worst decisions. And in fact, you are the mastermind behind all of your own worst decisions, which points to an interesting truth. It turns out that I don't always have my best interest at heart. It turns out that you don't always have your best interest at heart as much as you, but you think, but I'm just so selfish. Of course I have my best. No, you don't. You don't, actually. You don't have your best interest at heart, and neither do I. Which, if that's the case, we cannot rely on leading ourselves by ourselves. We talked about this verse last night, but it bears repeating. Proverbs 13:20 says, "He who walks with the wise will be wise, but the companion of fools will suffer harm." Or another way of saying that is your friends will determine the quality and direction of your life. Something we say and challenge a lot at USC. Your friends will determine the quality and direction of your life. This is something you can leverage for your benefit, or it's something that can undermine your future. But it is true. So I suggest you surround yourself with people who don't just share your interests, but they really share your like-hearted values, assuming your values are that of Jesus. And if they're not, get around people who do have some values like Jesus, and then learn from them. Now, you can be around, obviously, people with different sets of values. You ought to be. That's how we're salt and light in the world. But there's a difference between having friends that have a different set of values versus those being your heart friends, the people that are your reference group, the people that you're looking at them and like, yeah, I want to emulate that, and I want to be like that. I want them to be spurring me on. There's a difference there. Because as much as you want to try, sometimes, I see people do this all the time, they want to be the exception to the rule of Proverbs 13:20. They go, yeah, well, I know that it's the case, but see, in my particular case. But the problem is, you're not going to be an exception. You'll just be a statistic, but that verse is true. Harold Bullock, again, another great quote he had one time, he said, "Everyone is going to prove that the Bible is true, either by obeying it or disobeying it. But everyone's going to prove that it's true." You know, so it's not a matter of if, it's just how. So I suggest surrounding yourself with two kinds of wise people, wise peers and wise mentors. You need both. You need wise peers because they really serve as sort of your running mates in life. People that are going to encourage you and spur you on, and they're just in it, in the thicket with you in that age and stage of what you're going through. You need that. But you also need wise mentors in your life, people who are looking at the next 3 to 5 to 10 to 15 years of your life in their rearview mirror because they've already went through it, and they can guide you through that as you make those decisions. Not because they did it perfectly, but they've been on the other side of it. They know, they've learned from their mistakes. They're living wisely, and they can help guide you through that. So to lead yourself well, you need to make 3 decisions at least. One is, I will not lie to myself, even when the truth makes me feel bad about myself. Decision 2 is, I will prioritize what I value most over what I want now. And then decision 3 is, I will not attempt to lead myself by myself. Now, those decisions sound pretty good, right? It's not a bad list of decisions. The problem is, how do you begin to manage those decisions? How do you create systems in your life so you don't fall into the temptation of lying to yourself, or leading yourself by yourself, or prioritizing what you want now over what you want most? And so that's what I want to spend the remainder of our time talking about this morning is, how do you begin to put these things into practice? Because a goal without a plan is just a pipe dream. You know, many people have a desire and good intentions, but they don't have a plan that's time tested. And so they never really get to where they want to go. A quote I really like by Andy Stanley, he says, "It is direction, not intention, that determines destination." It is direction, not intention, that determines destination. You know, if I'm in downtown LA and I get on the 10 freeway headed west and I say, man, I so want to end up in Palm Springs, like with all my heart, it does not matter. I will end up in Santa Monica every single time. Why? Well, because that's where the 10 freeway west goes. It's like, but I so wanted to be in Palm Springs. It does not matter. It is direction, not intention, that determines destination. And that's true in life too. The Apostle Paul said it this way in Galatians 6:7. He says, what a man sows, that he will also reap. Now that is not to say that we plan every bit of our spiritual lives, but we do plan for our spiritual lives. If you're not growing, that's a self-inflicted wound. Like, that is no one else's fault. We do want to cooperate with God in his transformation of us through our schedules and our budgets and our relationships and daily habits and morning routines and so on. So we plan for it, but we're cooperating with God as he's doing it. Dallas Willard put it this way. I love this quote. I go back to it on a pretty regular basis, just kind of evaluate things. But it says, you must arrange your days so that you experience deep contentment and joy and confidence in your everyday life with God. You must arrange your days so that you experience deep contentment and joy and confidence in your everyday life with God. So simply put, what I think that's really how this plays out is you have to develop a healthy rule of life. You have to develop a healthy rule of life. Now, what is that? What is a rule of life? You may be wondering. A rule of life really is, it's a schedule and a set of practices and relation rhythms that really create space for us to abide and imitate and obey, becoming more like Jesus. It's an intentional way to organize our lives around what really matters most, which is what we've talked about, is God and his kingdom. For the first few centuries of the church, the phrase way of life or rule of life were kind of used interchangeably. So if you think, I don't like the idea of rule of life, okay, we can call it the way of life. It's basically the same thing. Now, it's not rules of life, it's rule of life. It is a way of going about living and organizing your life. Simply put, a rule of life is a plan to follow Jesus. It provides a support structure, much like a trellis does for a vine. If you see a picture here, there's a vine, and then there's the trellis that it's grown up on. And, you know, a trellis is a support structure to really lift the vine off the ground so that it can get the proper light and grow and breathe properly. It guides its growth into the desired direction. Our rule of life is like that. It's our trellis. It creates space, and it sort of supports us so that we, as a vine, can properly abide in, or as a branch, can properly abide in the vine, which is Jesus, and we can properly abide in him. Now, in case you didn't know, you may be thinking, wow, this is new stuff here, but it's not. You already have a rule of life. Now, you may not have heard of that term until right now, but every one of us has a rule of life. The question is your rule of life working or is it not? And do you like the results of it? But every one of us has a rule of life. A rule of life is an invitation to a very different definition of freedom than that of the modern world. It's an invitation to embrace the constraints that we would put on ourselves that really, at the end of the day, would actually set us free even more so. For example, it's kind of like a fish, you know, choosing to remain within the constraints of water. You know, if a fish said, I want to be free, and jumped out of the water, it wouldn't be free for very long. It'd be dead. Why? Because a fish thrives best in the constraints of water. And there are certain ways that we thrive best when we are not just utterly free to do anything we ever want. And so a rule of life is important because it's how we spend our days. That doesn't just determine what we do, but it determines the person that we're becoming. So a rule of life ought to do two things. Before I talk about what should be included in rule of life, I want to talk about a little bit about some things about it. One, a rule of life ought to do two things. It ought to guard and it ought to guide. It ought to guard and it ought to guide. It ought to guard what we want to put into our life and also what we want to keep out of our life. And a rule of life ought to guide what we want to grow in our lives and what we want to die in our lives. So it guards and it guides. Now, a key thought here, just to clarify some things on the rule of life here, guys. The rules of our life, they are not righteousness. They're not righteousness. They're wisdom. And what I mean by that is they're kind of like medicine. You know, best case scenario is you don't need them because you're healthy. But oftentimes we do because we're not always healthy. So we need to choose our constraints or they're going to really choose us. You know, the pressures of life and the people around us is going to really choose what we choose to be in a rule of life. Now, this requires focus. Steve Jobs, who many of you guys know, he's the brilliant man behind the rise of the company Apple. He had this to say about focus. He says, people think focus means saying yes to the things you've got to focus on, but that's not what it means at all. It means saying no to the hundreds of other things that there are, and you have to pick carefully. So rural life, it helps us focus by guarding and guiding what we put in our lives. And as is doing that, there are four things that a rural life accomplishes. Four things that a rural life accomplishes. One, it will help you turn vision into reality. It will help you turn vision into reality. You know, help you move from having kind of these aspirational ideas like, yeah, I want this to be true of my life, into really authentic transformation. By beginning to habituate traits into our bodies, which really literally begins to change things about who you are. It begins to rewire kind of the central nervous system, even so to speak. Another good thing a rural life does is it helps you experience peace as you live in alignment with your deepest desires. You know, I don't know about you, but I've noticed whenever my schedule is not aligned with my values, I live with just a low-grade anxiety and a low-grade just electric current kind of just pulsing through my nervous system. And it's just there. And I think that's just true for you guys too, because we can't live with the dissonance between what we value and how we spend our time. It just begins to drain the life out of us. But as we look at what God desires for us, and under that umbrella, as we begin to align our desires, our rule of life with those desires, we experience real peace. We experience real peace. And then the third thing a good rule of life does is it will help you live at the right pace. It'll really help you live at the right pace. A good pace in life ought to be at least two things. It ought to be both stretching and sustainable. Both stretching and sustainable. It ought to be stretching in that it's uncomfortable at times because it's growing you. It's stretching your capacity. But it ought to be sustainable in that you don't burn out from it. You know, sometimes people are like, well, I'd rather burn out than rust out. It's like, well, actually, there's a third option. You can live out. You know, you can actually live out what you're doing. So a good schedule and a good pace ought to be both stretching and sustainable. And then a fourth thing a rural life does is it will help you balance freedom and discipline. It'll really help you balance freedom and discipline. It's kind of like a spiritual budget for your life. It's a map and a path. It's not a straitjacket. It's a guide, really. Your rural life is kind of like an anchor, and your life is kind of like the boat. You know, you don't really notice the anchor very much until your life starts to drift away from it, and then it tugs a little bit and kind of recenters you back to where you need to be. That's kind of what a rural life does for you. Let me talk just briefly too about what a rural life is not, because there's a lot of misnomers about this stuff, and I don't want you guys to fall into these traps. I think I have them listed here on the thing too. Yeah. Here's some things of what a rural life is not. One, a rule of life is not a barometer of spiritual maturity. It's not a barometer of spiritual maturity. You know, actually, love is the metric of spiritual maturity, not discipline. And that can be sometimes often that can be confusing and often misunderstood, particularly with younger people. They can think, man, you're really mature if you have discipline. You know, and you're like, actually, no. Your the main, you know, litmus test for spiritual maturity is actually the way you love people. You know, Jesus talked about that. John 13, 34. He says, the way you're going to know that you're my disciple is not that you have so much discipline. It's actually the way you love one another. Now, that will require discipline, but that's not the barometer for maturity. It's actually love. Spiritual disciplines and rhythms, they are the path. They're not the destination. They help us become people of love, but they are not the goal in themselves. Second thing is, it's not a gloomy bore. You know, many of the practices actually are really joyful activities. And those ones that don't feel like that at first, over time, what you find is they really do lead to joy. And then third, it's not a form of merit. A rule of life is not a form of merit. Again, spiritual disciplines are simply a means to tapping into or growing towards the life that God graciously offers to us. They're really conduits of God's grace to flow into our lives. You know, the bottleneck is not God's grace supply, nor is it God's desire to let us live out of his grace. The bottleneck is often our choice to not tap into and to plug into the grace and help that he has to offer us. And spiritual disciplines and a real life really help us do that. And then fourth, it's not a Christian version of virtue signaling. Matthew 5:16 says, let your light shine before men that they may see your good deeds and glorify your Father who is in heaven. You know, people actually ought to see your character on display. They ought to see your good deeds on display, but your practices, your real life that allowed those things to flow into your life and to grow into your life, those are the things that Jesus talks about need to be more hidden in general. People ought to be able to see our character and see our things and how we live, but our disciplines, not so much. And in fact, doing the disciplines for the wrong reason can sometimes backfire. Sometimes it can cause things to work against you. So again, they're not a Christian version of virtue signaling. And then fifth, it's not a means of control. Sometimes if you have a personality that's a little more bent to want to control everything around you, your environment, you may think, yeah, it's a rule of life. And if you're not so much, you're thinking like, rule of life, you know, but it's not a means of control. We practice the disciplines to better follow a known God into an unknown future, not to control either. Let me say that again, just so you wrap your mind around that. We practice the disciplines to better follow a known God into an unknown future, not to control either of them. You know, we're following God. He is the one we're following. We're not following the disciplines. The disciplines and the rule of life, that is just a helpful way to better follow a known God into an unknown future. But, I mean, we're married to him. We're not married to the disciplines. If we need to change those at any point, we can, if that helps us better follow him. The practices are disciplines based on the lifestyle of Jesus that create space and time for us to really access living out of his power, like we've talked about, and to really being transformed from the inside out. Now, here's a definition for you of a discipline. If you're like, so what technically is a discipline here? A discipline is any activity that I can do by direct effort that will eventually enable me to do what I currently cannot do by direct effort. Now, that may be a mouthful, but let me break it down a little more. Again, a discipline is any activity that I can do by direct effort that will enable me to do what I currently cannot do by direct effort. So, for example, you see in the Bible that it says to be patient. And I say, hey, it's there. It's written. Be patient. Just be patient. Stop it. Be patient. You know, it's like, well, just because you saw that it was written there doesn't mean you're probably going to be able in all situations just to be patient and not get frustrated. But, you know, one thing I found when I get proper sleep, just as one example, I tend to be more patient. I don't know about you guys. Have you noticed that? When you get proper sleep, you tend to be more patient. So, in my life, oftentimes, getting proper sleep is a spiritual discipline that enables me to do what I cannot do by direct effort alone, which is just to be patient in the moment. And there's lots of other examples of ways you could think about that. But that's kind of basically what a discipline is. It's something that you can do by direct effort that allows you to eventually do what you cannot do by direct effort alone. Now, this requires training, not just trying. Our part is to really slow down, to really make space, and to surrender to God through practicing the spiritual disciplines. But it's His job to really transform us. We're not in the business transformation. That's His job. But we can get in the way of Him transforming us. Again, like I talked about before, it's much more like physical therapy than it is like plastic surgery. Have you noticed in the Gospels? I challenge you, read through the Gospels. You will never see once Jesus healing someone of being a jerk. Have you noticed that? Like, He never just heals someone of a bad character. Now, He heals people with diseases. He heals people with demons. He helps people that were blind to see. He helps, you know, people who had leprosy. But He never goes, you know, be healed of being lazy. Be healed of being a terrible husband. You know, be healed of being someone who can't control their mouth. No. What does He do? He says, follow me. Follow me. And begin to implement the things in my life. And as you do, you will become more like me. And you'll learn to actually change in other ways. So the practices, they aren't everything, but they're really, really important. They're non-negotiables for those who desire to really be with and become like Jesus. And they won't carry us all the way, but they will put us on the path. And there's something we never really mature beyond, at least not in this life. But we must arrange and rearrange our lives around them constantly. And if we do so, the automatic response of sin in our bodies will slowly begin to be rehabituated and be removed to where the natural result is just to do the things that Jesus taught us to do. And we begin to naturally live out the teachings of Jesus every day in our lives as God becomes more and more real to us and we're drawn into just the Trinity's inner life of love. So now that I've given you a little context and background on a rule of life, I want to briefly just walk through what would be some rhythms or some practices or some disciplines, whatever you would like to call that. That really, you see, are time-tested and biblical ones that could serve as the foundation for a rule of life for you and me as followers of Jesus. Now, again, this isn't exhaustive. I mean, again, a spiritual discipline could be, again, anything that enables you to do and follow Jesus in an area that you could not do by direct effort alone. It requires God's help, but we also have a role to play in that. And then once I kind of walk through these nine. I'll have some brief suggestions on a few tips for implementing them. And I'm not going to talk about these exhaustively. Each one of these could be a message in and of themselves, but it's just kind of give you a little overview of it. So the first one is this. First discipline or practice in a good rule of life is the practice of Sabbath. You know, guys, tiredness is an unavoidable thing this side of heaven. So if you think, you know, when am I ever going to not be tired? Never. That's just part of life. However, many of us operate on a dangerous level of tiredness. So much so that we just can't make sense of God's presence and really hear His voice well. So a good practice to implement is a weekly Sabbath where you take extended time to really rest physically, and to rest mentally and spiritually, where you have extended time to really just enjoy being with God, enjoy being with people you really love being around, some extended time just to have the goal of not trying to accomplish something, other than simply enjoying and being with God and resting and getting recharged. Now, if you can do an entire day, that's great, but if that's not where you can start out in your schedule either because you just don't think you have the time to do that, or for a variety of reasons, maybe that just doesn't make sense right now to do that. Man, I would encourage you, start off even with a few hours. Maybe a few hours during a morning or an evening where you're not just, you know, like, all right, good, I get an extra evening just to hit the sticks and play video games. No, that's not what I'm talking about. Don't let that be your Sabbath activity. There's a difference between resting and distraction, by the way. That's another talk. But, you know, there's many things we do that distract us, but they don't refresh us. On our Sabbath, we want to do things that are refreshing. And that help us really connect with God and his people. And then the second practice is solitude and silence. Solitude and silence. You know, once we're rested, the quiet is where we go to find God. Now, I'm not suggesting you go off and like become like John the Baptist or like become some monk that lives out in the caves in the desert and stuff like that. That'd be a little weird. But what I am suggesting is we need regular time of solitude and silence where we aren't talking. For some of us, that's going to be really hard, including myself. And we aren't around noise so that we can just be in the presence of God and learn from him and be with him. You see, Jesus modeled this a lot in the New Testament. You see other people in the Bible model this. You see this modeled throughout a lot of men and women throughout church history as well. And what solitude and silence does is it frees us up from really being caught in the hamster wheel of the feelings and the thoughts and just the habitual actions that this world has us get in that really can kind of set us against the ways of God. It helps us fight those tendencies and needing to really find our worth and productivity or what others think of us. And ironically, one of the things about solitude and silence that I've discovered over the years is it's actually the cure to loneliness too. Because when you're alone with God, you realize actually you're never really alone because he's with you. And so I don't know about you, but as an extrovert, it was unnerving to be alone by myself for very much time at all. But over time, as I began to learn to get more alone time with God, I actually craved it. I enjoyed it. And I wasn't so needing to be around people or being affirmed by people or just be in people's presence all the time. Not that I don't enjoy that, but it wasn't a must as much. So I would encourage you, begin to build times of solitude and silence into your schedule. Begin to build small bits of it into your life on a daily basis, just even when you're having your quiet time, just having little bits of time where you're in a quiet, undistracted place. And then maybe even begin to build a little bit of a larger chunk of time to that, maybe on a monthly basis. Maybe you do it for a couple hours or half a day or something like that. And then the third practice in a good rule of life is prayer. Prayer. You know, Jesus didn't go into the quiet place to have solitude and silence because he was an introvert and he just needed some me time with a good cup of coffee. Like, that was not why Jesus went into the quiet place. He went to the quiet place because he wanted to pray. He wanted to be with the Father. Nothing wrong with some me time and a good cup of coffee, but that's not why we have solitude and silence for you introverts. We must learn to really talk with God. We must learn to talk to God and really learn to listen to God too and be with him in prayer. And in a prayer life, guys, you don't want to just develop a prayer life, but you want to develop a prayerful life where we're in constant conversation with God, like we talked about, learning to practice his presence, and where the lines of communication are just always open between us and God. Where we can talk to him, and maybe there are specific things that you pray about on certain days of the week or certain people or things, and that's great. You ought to have lists like that, but also just learning to develop a prayerful life where you're in constant dialogue and conversations. You know, again, kind of like my wife and I, like, we may have a date night, but that doesn't mean that's the only time we hang out, you know. And then for those people that go, well, you shouldn't have to have a scheduled date night. If you love each other, you'll just make time for each other. That's hilarious. You obviously don't have much in your schedule. Like, it's amazing when you get busy how you have to, like, schedule time with people you live with. Like, when are we going to hang out? So, yes, I mean, impromptu times, that's great. And you ought to have that. But you also have scheduled times. But it's a both and, not a one or the other thing. And then a fourth practice that's really good to implement in your life is fasting. Fasting. That may sound really odd to some of you. It did to me at first, too, because I love food. Now, this practice is often accompanied by prayer, which you see in the scriptures, Elias. And when you fast for food, whether that be for one meal or whether that be, you know, for an entire day or whatever it is, what you're learning to do in fasting is you're learning to depend upon God for sustenance other than just physical food. As you yield your body to God, you're breaking the power of the flesh control over your body, and you're learning to literally feast upon every word that proceeds from the mouth of God that's not just bread. You know, bread and food, like, all that is just congealed word of God, you know? But man lives on every word that proceeds from the mouth of God. Now, some of that word that proceeds from the mouth of God is food, but he actually can sustain you in ways other than just physical food. And as you fast, you begin to learn to realize that, and you learn to depend on him. One of the things fasting tends to do sometimes too is it helps you learn to be sweet when you don't get what you want. You know, in that case, food. And, you know, how many of you guys ever struggle with being hangry? Anyone ever have that as an issue? Yeah. That's can be a real thing. And it can be a thing in other things too. It's like, it's amazing how God has over time just really helped me in self-control in a lot of areas of life beyond just eating. As I practice fasting, with my attitude, with my perspective, and learn to really depend upon him for that. And so for me, what that looks like practically is, at this season of my life, I usually will fast about one day a week, typically Wednesdays. And so I don't, my last meal will be Tuesday night at dinner, and then my next meal will be Wednesday night at dinner. And during that time, on when I'm would be eating otherwise, I don't just take extra time just to like hustle and get more stuff done. I usually spend that time to pray. So the time I'd usually be making breakfast or lunch or eating it, I'll take that time, the extra time to pray. And then as my stomach growls throughout the day, I just use that as a trigger to pray too. And actually, at first that was difficult. Ironically, now Wednesday is my favorite day of the week. Like, I really enjoy it actually, because I feel just, my mind feels clear. I feel more just tapped in to the presence of God and be able to connect with him on things. And it's fun. It's fun to do. And then it makes Wednesday dinner really fun. And then the fifth habit in a rule of life is scripture. Scripture is the primary way that we're really transformed by the renewing of our mind that Paul talks about in Romans 12:2. As you begin to hear God's word spoken, as you read God's word, as you memorize God's word, as you study God's word, as you meditate on it, as you begin to apply it to your life, God's word slowly but surely begins to develop you more and more into the mind of Christ, and you become more and more like him. And this is something that we want to do on a daily basis, and then at other times you want to do it on an extended basis. Like, for instance, for me, on my Sabbath, which is most often Mondays, I will try to get some extended time in between doing things with the kids and my wife. Sabbath just looks really different when you have three little kids. But, you know, I'll try to get some extended time just to be able to read and pray, and even more so than I would other days of the week. And then the sixth one is community. Community. John Ortberg, who was a pastor and author in the Bay Area, he wisely observed this. He said, you know, we generally sin alone, but we heal together. We generally sin alone, but we heal together. You know, we were, like I said yesterday, we were not meant to walk with God solo. Our relationship with God ought to be personal, but it's not meant to be private. It ought to be personal, but it's not meant to be private. So really be intentional with buying up quality time and community with other believers, whether that be at church or in your small groups and challenge or the large group time or one-on-ones or whatever, just making it a point to make that a regular rhythm in your life, because you need that. You need to be spurred on. You need to be encouraged. And even if you don't need to be spurred on and encouraged at the moment, other people need to be spurred on and encouraged. And so it's not just a one-way street. You're there to encourage them too. And then the seventh practice in a good rule of life is generosity. Generosity. Now, this is actually one of the most joyful of all the practices. When we give of our money or our resources or our time or our love, we get to participate in really the divine outflow of love as we get to direct and guard and guide our hearts from being ruled by money and other possessions. Acts 20, verse 35, Jesus said, "It is better to give than to receive." And that is true. I mean, the more you begin to practice a heart of generosity, that is not just a cliche statement. You go, that is absolutely true. It is better to give than to receive. So I'd encourage you to have both planned and spontaneous giving in your life. Planned meaning, there may be some things, whether it's to church or to challenge or to, missionaries or whatever it is, or other people that you regularly give of your money and your time, and it's just built into the rhythm of your budget and the rhythm of your schedule and stuff like that. But also having spontaneous times of that. My wife and I, at least with our finances, one of the things we do is we have a fund we call our GOK fund, God Only Knows, and we regularly put money in that fund to just have spare money in our budget to bless people and to help people. And we don't know who it's going to be to or when it's going to be, but we know it's there for opportunities to do that with people. And same with our schedules too. If you fill up every single second of your week, you don't have any margin to be able to be a help to other people and to be generous with your time. So have some white space in your schedule where you intentionally don't do everything you could do so that you have space to do what God might lead you to do in helping other people. So ask yourself when it comes to generosity, what do you have to give? What do you have to give? Or put it another way, how badly do you want joy? Because I can guarantee you the people that are the most joyful are the most generous. So if you don't like joy, be selfish. But if you like joy, I encourage you, be generous. And then the eighth one is service. Like generosity, it ought to be both planned and a lifestyle of spontaneous service. We don't want to just be willing to serve. This is something we talk about a lot in our ministry, UFC. You don't want to just be willing to serve. You want to be planning to serve. You want to be expecting to serve. So, it's great to come into a room or come into a situation, and if someone asks you to serve, you're like, yeah, I'm willing to serve. That's great. That's better than being like, no, we're not. But even better if you enter a room or into a situation where you are looking for and expecting to serve. You're trying to find ways to serve and doing that. When we serve, we not only bless others, but we also emulate Jesus. And as we serve others, it really frees us from being trapped by our ego, being trapped by a sense of entitlement and self-obsession. And ironically, when we serve, it actually begins to free us from being trapped by wondering what other people think about us. It's what the Bible calls the fear of man. Because you're not in bondage to that anymore when you serve, because you realize, hey, I'm just going to serve people. And then the last one as a good basis for a good rule of life is witness, learning to witness. We are to share the good news about Jesus regularly and naturally. Now, in our next session tonight, I'm going to give more specifics about that and this particular practice, so I'm not going to go into it real in depth right now, because sometimes there can be some real confusion around what that looks like to just share Jesus naturally and regularly. But it's something we definitely want to be as a practice in a regular rule of life. And in a culture of hostility, where sometimes people can be hostile to us doing that, one of the things we want to do is we want to practice regular hospitality as part of your rhythm of witness, where you're regularly inviting people into your life, you're inviting people into your home, you're inviting people to eat food with you. It's hard to argue with someone when they make you a really good sandwich or a really good pizza or something like that. And so, learn to invite people into your life. Learn to leverage your dorm, leverage your apartment, leverage your food, leverage your, have some GOK money set aside to regularly buy someone a cup of coffee or some meal, and just practice hospitality with other people as you're looking to share and witness with them. Now, in closing, I want to just give you a few tips to get you started with these practices and developing a rural life, some ways to go about beginning to implement them. Number one, start where you're at, not where you should be. Start where you're at, not where you should be. You know, God has yet to bless anyone except where they actually are. I don't know if you know that or not. But so if you're just beginning, start small with just some joyful, easily attainable practices, and then begin to build from there. Don't look at this list and go, oh, no, got to implement all these in my life. No, you don't. Just eventually that might be helpful. But start with one and begin to go from there. Number two, think subtraction, not addition. Think subtraction, not addition. You know, in other words, we don't just think, you know, well, all right, I've got to add these nine rhythms and disciplines to my life. No, it may be that what you need to do initially some is you may need to prune some things out of your life before you begin to add some of those other things to your life to make room for them. And then number three is take a balanced approach. You want to have both practices of abstinence and practices of engagement in your life. Practices of abstinence would be things like solitude and fasting and Sabbath and generosity. These are things, again, where you learn to abstain from doing certain things so that you can do other things. And then there's practices of engagement like prayer, and Bible reading, and community meals and things like that. And then number four, take into account your personality and your spiritual temperament. This is going to require getting to know yourself. It's going to require kind of understanding what age and stage of life you're in, your wiring, and begin to experiment with different practices. And again, your rural life doesn't have to look exactly the same as someone else around you because we're different. And again, these practices, they're not righteousness. They're wisdom. So begin to figure out how does a good rural life work for you? And then number five, follow the J curve. Follow the J curve. Now, if you notice a J, I'm going to try to do it the way you guys would see it. Yes, there we go. If you notice a J, it starts here, and then it begins to slope down before it slopes back up. And honestly, that's how many of us are when we start new things. You know, when you begin to start something new, you tend to do it worse, and things are a little worse until you get better at it. And so don't get discouraged when you start something new. You think, oh, life is more complicated and hard because I started this new thing. Yeah, said everybody. And so, like, that's normal. So stick with it. And the more you begin to implement it, the more you'll see how it's helpful in your life. And then number six, do this in community. Do this in community. You know, a rural life, historically, was always something that was done in the context of community. It wasn't just for individuals alone. So make your rural life your own, you know, tailor it to yourself, but as much as possible, do it in community with other people. And then the last one is, remember that there is no formation without repetition. There is no formation without repetition. We want to be in it for the long haul, but change is slow, guys. Like, change is slow and it's often monotonous, but it is possible and it's worth it. So take the long-term view here. Your life probably won't look that different as you begin to implement this over a course of a week or a month, maybe over a course of about a year. You might begin to see some fruit and some change there. You think a year, it's like, well, you're going to be that age anyway. Might as well be a little further down the road, assuming you live that long. And so, I mean, an example for myself is like, as I began to implement the practice of Sabbath in my life, which I didn't really began to start implementing that more until my late 20s, early 30s. It honestly took about 2 years of putting into practice before I began to see the benefits of it in my life. I knew it was a wise practice, but I was just more neurotic about it, and I was just, you know, annoyed about doing it before I really saw the value of it, probably for a couple of years. And that's true with a lot of things, so just stick with it. So before we lead ourselves, or lead others well, which we're going to talk about in our last session, we have to learn to lead ourselves well. And that's going to require we make at least three decisions. One, I will not lie to myself, even when the truth makes me feel bad about myself. I will prioritize what I value most over what I want now. And then I will not attempt to lead myself by myself. And in order to consistently live those decisions out, we have to learn to develop and implement a rule of life that will act as sort of the trellis for our lives so that we can better abide and imitate and obey Jesus in what we're doing.